Occhio destro dominante.
Right eye dominant.
Rechtes Auge dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Høyre øye dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Align lumna almuhaimina to.
Right eye dominant.
This is the Right Eye Dominant podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast. I am your host, Nick Taro Jr. Thanks for joining me today. On today's episode, I have a great special guest on board for an interview. His name is Giancarlo Roma. And Giancarlo actually is part of a pretty impressive photographic family lineage. His father is noted photographer Thomas Roma. And his grandfather happens to be the masterful photographer Lee Friedlander. And the reason why I wanted to talk to Giancarlo today is because he is the manager and handles distribution for Haywire Press, which is the publishing imprint that Lee Friedlander created to distribute his own photo books. And so going back to the origin story of Haywire Press, when Lee Friedlander first started self-publishing and, you know, the sale of the photo books was literally door to door, Giancarlo and I talk about those humble beginnings and how Lee Friedlander's legacy and prolific photo book publishing is being carried forward by a new generation and for a new generation on the shoulders of Giancarlo himself. So I thought he would be a wonderful guest for the podcast, and so that's where we're going today. Without further ado, let's get into my conversation with Giancarlo Roma. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast, Giancarlo Roma.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. So the focus of the podcast is primarily photography with I like to focus on a whole range of topics that connect to photography, with the exception of gear talk. I hate gear talk, and most podcasts and YouTube channels seem to focus on that. So I pivot the other way. Part of it is a little bit of sort of my love for photography history and also book publishing. And I think that you live in, you have feet in both those worlds. So I thought mm-hmm. it would be great to have you as a guest on the show today. So thank you for joining me. That's my preamble.
I appreciate it. I don't know too much about gear, so that works out.
Awesome. So why don't we start by you just maybe giving a little bit of a background about who you are and why we're probably having this conversation today.
Yeah, so my name is Giancarlo Roma, as you mentioned. I'm a writer, but photography is sort of in my family. My grandpa's Lee Friedlander on my mom's side, and then my dad is photographer Thomas Roma, and so I grew up with it kind of on both sides of my family. quick note about gear, I'll just get it completely out of the way because it's my gear connection, but my dad actually makes his own cameras in his machine shop and in my backyard growing up. So I kind of grew up with it, and there's a dark room in my top floor of our house that he made. So actually the whole top floor is a dark room. So I sort of grew up with it literally and metaphorically in the house.
Right.
And this is also black and white film photography. I always have trouble explaining to people. It's, you know, it's not fashion. It's not whatever, wedding photography. It is art photography, if that is the right word. So it is a niche within a niche, I guess I would say. And I've collaborated on a few projects with my dad, writing wise, and we've done a few books together. And then I have a business with my grandfather where I sell his own copies of his own books signed. So trade books, he's published about, depending on how you count, maybe 80 or so. Mm-hmm. portfolios, special editions, basically everything the galleries don't sell. Galleries generally sell prints, things you could hang on the wall, all the rest of the stuff, what you might call the, you know, printed and bound matter. That's not really their bread and butter. I handle for Lee. And we also published a book a few years ago. So we get into that as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the growing up in a photographic family. And for me as a photographer myself and just enthusiast about the art form, and when you it's funny how you were kind of dancing around sort of the description of like the kind of work that, you know, your dad does, and also your grandfather. I think, like, to a layperson, it unless you are aware of like the kind of work that they produce, it is a little difficult to just sort of like, well, yeah, they're photographers, but no, they're not wedding photographers, or well, no, they're not fashion photographers, you know. And this is partially the reaching out to you to have this discussion is like, I know both these men and their work, and so I'm like, wow, what's that like to grow up in that environment? And I would love to hear about just sort of your personal reflections on that. And it might not be, you know, I mean, it's still your family. It's not like, you know, it's, you know, like, so you have a different relationship, obviously, as like from me as a viewer, but I'm just curious what it was like. How aware were you of this sort of world that you were growing up in?
Yeah. I mean, some of it's a range, because some of it is just being photographed more than other people probably were. I mean, now actually with camera phones, I probably photograph far less than most people growing up. But at the time, you know, just having the experience of being photographed in, and not just for posterity, you know, but in a more like artful sense. Like I remember, you know, sometimes whether if I'd be, I played baseball growing up on a travel team where we played constantly. We played like 100 games a year. And, you know, whether I was in the backyard hitting or across the street looking at the moon, I remember there's a picture of that. And, you know, my dad would be photographing me in his process. You know, he's very, he has the ability to sort of be invisible, like not invisible, but like calming in a sense where you don't feel like he's intruding, like you feel like you're just doing what you were doing naturally, but also a director. So he would say sort of like, oh, wait, what that thing you were doing, he kind of, I mean, now I kind of know the trick of it, but like pretend like he didn't really see, like, oh, what was that thing you're doing with your hand? Oh, this? Oh, wait, can you just do that one more time? Let's just see. And you know what I mean? So it's sort of a combination of lulling you into a false sense of security, but also being very intentional with how you look and having that photographer's eye, obviously, for how something's going to look photographed. You're going to see it later and that'll play a certain way. Mm-hmm. So there was that sort of experience where I kind of, from a young age, felt the art form, you know, even physically, like what, and then you'd see the picture and you see, okay, oh, that's what was interesting about, I remember that day. Oh, that's, I wouldn't have thought it would come out that way. And just having the sense of, just the art form and how it translates, like the, you know, the alchemy of it, just like any art form has this sort of process of how you go from like a real world thing to art. Mm-hmm. I mean, every art form has a version of that. And I had a sense of it with that. With my grandfather, it was interesting because it was very different. He's kind of known for this, but he has his camera on him at all times. I mean, all times. And like an almost like a necklace, you know, some people just wear, I mean, I wear a necklace, I never take off, and his camera is that for him. It's just, it's always there. And so if you're at dinner or, you know, even in the house a lot or whatever, he's talking, nodding. And then, you know, like a gunfighter, you know, just comes out, pop, he doesn't even look through the lens sometimes. And he just, you know, he's been at it for a long time. So he kind of just kind of has a sense of it, but it's much more where my dad, I think, was more, his approach is more about like it maybe takes him longer. It's like a more meditative process, maybe even more collaborative if it's there's someone in it. Mm-hmm. But I've even seen him shoot landscapes per se, but like, you know, street photography, where it's static, nothing's moving, and it takes him a while. You know, it's not like wham bam, he's lining it up. It's just, and it's how he is as a person. My grandpa, in my experience, is just instinct. It's a very, very quick transmitter from, I don't want to even say mind, maybe heart to finger. You know,
yeah,
I don't
yeah.
even know that it goes through the mind. It might just be something that's really inborn and it just happens and he does it. And it's, and that's the end of, you know, and then it's the end of it until you obviously make the contact sheet, develop the film and everything. But it was interesting. I was pretty aware of it from a young age, like how different my role in the as a subject was, and just seeing the process from that perspective. But also, you know, outside of, and it's interesting to look back now, because I'm in a few of my dad's books and I'm in a few of my grandpa's books, and I've just seen even prints that weren't published. I've seen a bunch of them, and it's just interesting to look back at your own childhood through that lens. And people have said this to me, it's kind of funny. It's like, oh, it's funny, your family albums are actual books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of true. And it's funny to look at your, you know, remembering, oh, I remember that day we all got dinner or whatever. And then it's, you know, and then other people have come up to me at openings and stuff and said, oh, you know, my favorite book of your grandfather's is the family book. And I'm like, why? What do
yeah.
You know, and because my relationship to it is partially just having lived it and the memory of it. And there's just like, oh, but it's a family story. And you could see there's an arc, there's a trajectory, there's a narrative. And I mean, I'm thrilled that other people see those things into it. And I'm sure they're there. But, you know, I obviously have a different relationship to it. And I'm grateful that those records exist. But, you know, there's another aspect to it of, like I kind of alluded to earlier, just with the art form. And I've always written from a young age, and I always wanted to be a writer. But I also grew up in a creative household and in a creative family, so I know that influenced me in some way. But as opposed to other art forms, photography is to me interesting because this was the criticism early on with it. It's like the most derivative, right? It's like people talk about, oh, capturing a moment and mm-hmm. just, oh, you were there at the right place at the right time. And it sort of reduces it to like either luck or like skill in the same way that like, you know, and I don't know, like just skill, more like less creative, more just, you know, how to operate the machinery, you know, mm-hmm. when to be somewhere with the light. It kind of reduces it to like, not the same way as a painter or sculptor. You'd never say that about a painter. You'd never say the Mona Lisa really captured the moment she was sitting there. You know, it doesn't translate at all. But I think what it, for my, like what it did to me created or did for me creatively was made the world kind of endlessly interesting as the source material. You know, I think especially with writing, it's all about, oh, your imagination. You must have a big imagination. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, you need that. But it's also an ability to be receptive to the world around you and use that as sort of, you know, you have your antenna up and you're always inputting, just like a photographer, a street photographer, you're walking around, especially, you know, New York, I'm looking at it right now, like there's an infinite amount of, literally an infinite amount of things to photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the skill and the artistry of it is being receptive and then sort of sorting and sifting, you know, like people do for gold. And that I think is, something I try to bring to my creative life. And I think that's mostly because just knowing that how the process works and seeing it and being with my dad and while he's photographed, and I would say being with my grandfather when he's photographed, but that just means to be with him, you know, they're kind of one the same, like he's sort of always on the clock. And I that to me is what's interesting about photography, is that, you know, the same thing it kind of got criticized for in the beginning and maybe even still today, is sort of what I find beautiful about it. And it's what I've heard my, you know, my dad and my grandpa talk about it, this sort of like endless love of the world. And it's a weird thing to say because we're all living in the world. There's no other place, right? But mm-hmm. it does imply a sort of spiritual connection, in a sense, to just, you know, almost commit your life to sorting it in a sense. Like there is, I don't, maybe that's not the perfect word, but with photography, there is a sense of trying to make sense of it rather than just purely documenting and say, this is what it is. That's how it looked like that day. There's more to it than that, obviously.
Yeah. And well, and actually like you, the, you made a couple of comments where it is like, you're sensitive. You're always hypersensitive to your surroundings, but also there is an aspect of the sifting that an interesting sort of correlation, because literally like if, you know, and, you know, I know your dad and your grandfather, their approach is obviously different. Yes. As you described, but I think there's an aspect to it where the capture of the moment with the camera is sort of like just like this sort of raw grabbing of information. And then whether it's like looking at the contact sheets and then creating prints afterwards, is that like sifting that you're describing? I was also struck by, like, you know, like you mentioned, Lee's like, he's always on the clock, right? So I have read that your father is more like, you know, like I was reading an interview with him and it was like, you know, he goes out to photograph. It's like, okay, now I'm sort of like, I'm in that mode. And whether it's meditative or being just ultra receptive, I think it's like, okay, now I'm putting on, like I'm getting the camera out and I'm going to do it. Where the description of Lee always like that sort of like having it, you know, like a necklace. And then just at any time a photograph presents itself and he's like laser quick with it. Or like you said, like a gunfighter. I think that reflects in his work as well. Clearly prolific. And I think will maybe lead to the book discussions. But, you know, the thing that always struck me about his work was that there is like, yes, prolific, but there's like a complexity in there's a complexity to the images, regardless of what the subject matter is, but nothing is haphazard. He's instilling some kind of compositional or structural sort of framework to things in the world. And the way you describe sort of the camera comes up and then goes away, and that might imply a lot of chance or, you know, happenstance to like what gets captured. But then I look at, and this may be an editing thing or just mm-hmm. like that sifting that you're describing. But even if there's something where the horizon's not straight or there's a line that just breaks down the middle of the frame, it's not just chance or chaos.
Right. Right. I think with my grandfather, it's a lot of it is very inborn, and also just the result of having done it for 70 plus years, 75 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. But yes, there's a sort of a recognition of formal element. I mean, and you see this in other art forms. I mean, improv, right? There's a whole genre of improv, and it's not like, oh, well, improv is, it's impressive, but it's worse than written. Like sometimes it's often funnier, you know, and then there's, it's true with other genres. If you've ever seen someone make up a song on the spot, and I have, a lot of times they're better than the stuff they sit down and write. So
yeah,
there's a different sort of thing you get access to when you work that intuitively. And I think he's really done that. And again, it's not every time. I've also been with him photographing other places more, intentionally, like you were described, like a almost like a photography trip. My family has taken to going out west about every 6 months now. I've been on parts of them, but I haven't been on all of them because they take about 2 weeks. But it's Southwest, so Arizona, even Texas, parts of California, Utah, and I've inherited my grandfather's love for the desert and for mm-hmm. Arizona specifically. Mm. And I've been with him going through different parts of the desert. I mean, specifically around Tucson is where we all love to go. There's a hotel there that we love. So we sort of branch out and we go to different national parks and state parks. And mm-hmm. And there's a lot of it that is truly, truly barren. We're the only ones around. And, you know, we stopped the car either where we can or where he would like to. If he saw something, then we'll sort of keep it running and half pull off. And I've seen him do the opposite, not just the, you know, kind of quick pitch stuff, but, you know, walk around and wait and set up and then look and then take it down. There was nothing, you know, I didn't see what he thought he saw and then move it. You know, so I've seen him do both, and it's always interesting to me how it works. You can, it's almost, I mean, maybe to use a bad analogy, like a left brain, right brain thing, or that's more left brain. But I think, I mean, for everyone, but for him specifically, I know it's just like, it's, he's a, his instincts are so honed at this point, and he trusts them so completely. I mean, this, again, with any art form, and really maybe anything in general in life, you need to really trust your instincts. You can't, second guessing is, you know, is death for these things. And I think he's been, for good reason, so trusting of what he sees that he's able to snap a picture in half a second without looking through the lens every single time, but also able to look through the lens for 10 seconds and put the camera down. And it's easy come, easy go. There's no lingering on it. There's no, oh, I wish the light were different. You know, it's just whatever's there is what we're working with. Whatever we get, we'll figure it out later. Mm. And I think it all just comes back to trusting his instincts. I mean, again, there's an element of that with everything and with everyone, but I just see it so clearly in every way that he photographs, whether it's the quick approach or the sort of more, like you said, intentional. We're going to this place. We're going to walk around. We're going to see what's going on. We'll wait till the light's a certain way, you know?
Yeah, that's, and I think that just based on sort of the variety of his work, you could see sort of where that sort of split might happen. And I think also format wise, I know like there's some work that's clearly like a medium format square, or which is a different kind of shooting, obviously, than just kind of pulling up a 35 millimeter off your chest and popping away. So I'm envisioning being on a road trip with your grandfather while he's shooting. Like, to me as a photo nerd, that's just like I would love just to be like in the backseat hanging out for that, just because it's, you know, it's like, oh yeah. Like, you know, the disconnect for me is like, you know, he's your grandfather. You're like, you know, like if I was going to take a road trip with my grandfather, who's no longer alive, but I mean, it would be like, you know, like, yeah, like there's all that other stuff of just like, you know, like, oh, we got to stop and use the bathroom, or like, you know, like whatever. But by the way, it's Lee Friedlander, and he's like, you know, like creating like this, you know, adding to this legacy body of work. So to me, that's really like, it's fascinating. I've always thought like in Lee's life or work, like he's obviously showing a lot of himself. Literally self-portraits, family, shadows, friends, cats, whatever. Like, you think you get to know somebody through that work, yet you don't really know that person because, you know, you're only seeing them through that. And then to hear like your description of it, it's like, well, you know, like I've just always imagined like he's kind of shrouded in mystery in some ways. Yeah. And then to hear, you know, and it seemed like almost intentional. Like it was always kind of hard to pin down like interviews or like, you know, like the first time I was introduced to you and your connection with him was that you did a talk where the two of you were on a stage at Museum. Maybe MoMA.
Yeah, the New York Public Library. Yeah. Happened to be right across the street from it now. But yeah.
Right. And so, like, I was like, holy shit. Like, yeah, like, here's, like, you know, like, here's an opportunity, you know, and I don't know if he shies away from that kind of attention or spotlight.
Yeah.
But like, no, you know, like, you, like, oh, come on, Grandpa, let's go up and, you know, I'll be there with you. It was a very casual, fun conversation. You know, I was surprised by his sense of humor. You know, tell me a little bit about that sort of Am I reading that correctly, that there's this kind of controlled shroud that he operates behind?
Yeah, I mean, there is. I think the word I would use is less control and more just that's who he is. You know, he doesn't love talking about himself or his work. And I think he's very much someone that believes the work is what it is. And if you talk about it, it isn't necessarily even true or doesn't add anything to it, you know, I think in general art, if you need a whole placard to understand whatever paragraph to understand what you're looking at, then what is it? You know, that's not really, it's almost like cheating, you know? Mm. But yeah, that's what you saw in that interview. So that was, I think, 2017. And that came from, it was a while ago. I'll back up a little bit. I started, I have to really back up for this. So Haywire Press is the business that I have with him, where I sell his own copies of his own work. That name Haywire Press, I'll just say very quickly, cause it does sound like a publishing company, and it was, and half is still, but, was the name he used when he self-published, his first book, Self-Portrait, and then a few subsequent books, or I think two more of his first five or something like that. And it was, you know, this is before, I'm sure a lot of your audience would know this, but it's before there were many photo books at all. There were only mm-hmm. a few. And the stories he's told me of looking at the ones that did exist, it was like you knew someone that had a copy and you'd go to their house and like they weren't in libraries. They were, you know, a few copies of things flying around. And so he self-published under that name. My grandmother helped with the design, and she would go door to door in the city peddling them to bookstores for, I think, $3 or $5 a copy or something like that. But she'd literally go and take the bus in with, you know, however many books she could carry and go door to door and sell them. And that was I didn't even want to call it a business. That was just the enterprise of it. And so when I started selling books, for my grandpa, and I wrote about this, I'll talk a little later, but it was, he kind of asked me, he said, you know, I have too many books in the house and, you know, your grandmother's getting on before. Do you think you could sell some on eBay? He knew I'd sold stuff on eBay before. I said, yeah, sure. And then it kind of evolved over the next year or two into a website. And then, like you said, people don't, despite how vulnerable I think he is in a lot of his work, I mean, true, like, I think taking a selfie and posting on Instagram takes balls, for lack of a better term. I mean, he has whole books of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's, I mean, even the facial expressions are very often either quirky, creative, vulnerable, sad. I mean, it's, you know, where he's got wires hanging off him from a surgery. Like, that takes a lot, you know, when you really stop to think about it, it takes a lot of courage, and it's a very vulnerable thing to do. So there is that sense of giving himself to his work. But besides that, you know, people don't, he doesn't like interviews. He doesn't do them. It's not even a contrived thing. It's just not his thing. He doesn't
mm-hmm.
want to do it. So, I obviously know him well as a person, but I got to know him, I guess I would say, like, as a photographer really well through this business that we had together, where I would essentially drive up to my grandparents' house. It's about an hour plus, a little bit more north of where I live in Brooklyn. Go through, get the books from wherever they were. They're all throughout the house, just because over the years there's been so many books. I had to learn where they were, take them, sign them. I bring them back to Brooklyn, photograph them, ship them when people would buy them. But when we'd be going through the books, when I'd locate them and he'd sign them and we'd flip through them, he would speak about, I don't want to say like the formal elements of the photograph or whatever, but it was, oh, we were, you know, my grandma would kind of drift in and out of the room where we were there and we were seeing this person, and stories about the people in them or about the trips, or about putting the book together or who he was working with. And it was so interesting to hear about his creative life over the years that it spawned a couple things. One is a book we ended up doing called Friedlander First 50, which is a book about his first 50 books.
Mm-hmm.
It contained snippets of interviews we did. And I say interviews, very informal family conversations that lasted an hour or two, where I'd literally just hit record on my phone and sit with my mom and my grandma and grandpa. And we just talk about the books. And it took forever, but I'd go through and take the snippets I thought were interesting, and they're in this book. So, you know, I think that's probably the the biggest collection of his own thoughts on his own work that's out there. And I thought people would be really interested in it because of how little there is outside of that. But again, I mentioned the term lulling into a false sense of security, not that it was false, because obviously he knew what we were doing. But in that environment, you know, sitting in the living room of his home with the, you know, fire burning, we're looking through books over the course of hours. It, that to me is the, you know, that's something that I had such a lovely experience with it that I wanted to share it with people. And I thought other people might be interested in it. And it was a similar, it was a very similar impetus that brought on the New York Public Library interview that you mentioned. I think that was probably an hour and a half sitting on stage. I didn't think there was a shot he was going to do it, but Josh Schwong, who was at the New York Public Library at the time, approached me about it. He said, you know, they usually, there was a guy who worked there. His name is Paul Holdengraber. He's a very fun, smart guy. I don't think he's there anymore, but he usually does the interviews. They have a great speaker series. It, you know, Jay-Z was the, I think the kickoff one that year. And it's, I've been to other ones. It's a really great New York thing. But he said, you know, I think if you did it, meaning me, were the interviewer, I think Lee would go for it. Otherwise he wouldn't. And I was, I think I was 25 at the time. And I was like, okay, you know, sure. I mean, I'm more than happy to. Usually they do, you know, they have a whole research department that puts together, you know, they read by the biography, they do this, they do that. And they said, well, you kind of know all of it, right? You could just kind of do it. And I thought, yeah, okay. I mean, I had to prepare and everything. So, you know, I put together slides. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I had notes, I had slides, and it ended up going pretty well. And it was, we had a lot of fun. My mom had a great idea. She said, you know, you should start it with a song. That would really get, and don't tell grandpa. That would really, because my grandpa's, and this is known about him, he's a very big fan of jazz and blues and rhythm and blues and gospel. So we started and ended with songs. And especially the first one, he perked up. He was completely, really excited by it. And I think it just set the tone for what felt, at least to me, and I think to him, just kind of like we were talking in his studio. We were pretty unaware of the crowd. I feel like when we were doing sound check, it was actually kind of funny. We were, you know, I think there were maybe 500 seats there. And he turned to me, he said, Giancarlo, are these people all here for us? I said, yeah, they are. They will be, Grandpa. And he said, oh, well, we better not fuck it up then. And I said, and if you know my grandpa, like you said, he's funnier than you think. Like, if you know him, that's the sort of thing, you know, that's sort of his humor. And he said it laughing, but yeah, it was, I kind of billed it to him and it turned out, and I think it will remain as like, we're going to do this and then we're not going to do it again. You know, this is the interview. I don't think he'd spoken publicly really before. I think we did a little thing at APAD that year as sort of like a warm up. But before that, I don't think he'd spoken publicly in maybe 30 years or something. So
yeah,
he said, let's just do a good one. Let's have fun with it. It'll be a family thing. My, you know, my parents and my grandparents were in the front row and we were sort of, you know, we had a few jokes that included them during it. And, you know, and that'll be our interview.
Yeah, no, that's, it's, well, two things. That video is such a wonderful resource for, like, you know, someone like me that, you know, really would just, I loved the casual nature of it. And yeah, I think it would have been very different had it been an official, like you said, maybe it probably wouldn't have done it if you weren't involved with it. So that alone, I think, was just, it brings just a charm to it, which I really appreciate. But also the going back to the first 50, was that like those recorded interviews or recorded just conversations around the house as you described it?
Yeah.
Was that like, was the intention that like this would become a book, or was it, this is a significant opportunity to document and to record his thoughts and voice, to just because honestly, now we're looking at, he's an old man and there's a legacy involved, and the fact that he, you know, to me, that's just such a valuable resource, but that you are family, that clearly grants you access, but also there's a comfortable I think that, again, like whether he would have been open to having somebody come in and have those conversations, most likely he wouldn't. Did you feel the weight of it or the significance or the sort of that legacy sort of aspect to it?
Yeah, I think from a personal perspective, I thought, well, you know, this will be a great way for me to just learn more and have just have the, I mean, a record of it, but B, just to learn more about my grandparents. I say my grandparents because we didn't really know what was going to become of it. The real impetus was that I was putting together a collection of his first 50 books. And that's where Friedlander First 50 really came from. And actually, it's for sale on the website. It's boxed. They're actually, and I'm not even plugging them, but I'm more plugging the work it took to put 50 books in 5 boxes.
I'm looking at the website.
I just want people to see my handiwork because this took a really long time. And come with my mother's helping me measure foam to fit the books. And I'm almost more proud of just the conveyance than the endeavor of it. But
yeah,
we put together these first 50 books, and some didn't make the, I mean, again, I said earlier, depending on how you count. So there's like a Japanese exhibition catalog that's a beautiful, rare book that's for sale on the website. But my grandpa barely remembered it. He didn't sequence it. You know, there was some criteria, and I speak a little bit, but there's a note in the book about this. But just like, okay, what was the criteria for what to include, what to not? Because there's some along the way that got cut out. But so I made this box set, and I thought, okay, God forbid someone buys this, it gets delivered to them. Then, you know, then what? They're just sitting with a bunch of books that maybe they heard of 30% of, but the rest they have no idea. You know, it just seemed a little ridiculous. So I thought, why don't I try to put together some sort of pamphlet, and I'll have some quotes. And so I mentioned it to my grandpa, and he's like, I don't, you know, it's not my thing. I don't like, you know, talking about my work. I was like, all right, that's fair. I think it might have even been my dad who had this idea. He said, why don't you just talk to your grandmother? She has a memory like a steel trap. She remembers everything. In fact, even in the library, the New York Public Library interview, I think a few times he asks her as if she's sitting there with him. She's, you know, a few feet away, but still. What was the name of that? Whatever. Mm-hmm. So I would just talk to her about it. Say, well, you know, looking through the books, say, where were you? You know, just her recollections. And she had, you know, stories to tell. And my grandpa was kind of listening and say, oh, and then he would come in. And then it's sort of after a couple of times doing that, he would sit with us. So it, again, I keep saying false sense of security, but I kind of lulled him into the dynamic we already had. I think, like you said earlier, the idea of like an official thing where you're going to give quotes, like obviously that sounded horrible to him. Like, mm-hmm. He wants to be on record. Like, I took this because, you know, no photographer wants that. So when he kind of saw what it was, which is a super informal, like I'd forget we were recording constantly, and I was the one recording it, I think it became what it was, which was just like a normal family thing. Let's sit around. And he didn't really know what was, and I didn't really know like how the quotes would be included. And my mother has become a graphic designer, and she's excellent. And she has a publishing company called SBQR. Editions with my dad, and SBQR for the Latin scholars here. That's the Senate of the People of Rome. So it's
got it.
So that it was a co-publishing. It was Haywire Press X, you know, in collaboration with SBQR Editions. And so my mom kind of found this interesting way to lay out the quotes around. So each book has a spread. I'm miming it. No one can see it, obviously, but a spread. You can imagine, obviously, what that is. And each spread has pictures, a few pictures. Some of them relate directly to the quotes. It has all the information, all the boring stuff, how many pages. I'm just like the meat and potatoes of what it is. And then I wrote a description of each book just so people understand, like, you know, what the context was. Some were works that were started as a commission that were published, or sometimes, you know, there was a commission where they didn't end up using it and then it became a book years later. Just the backstory. And then the quotes are kind of jumping around the page, and I think even that design element makes it feel less official. Like, it's not a press release of like, this is what he has to say, but this is just what came of it, and a little here, a little there. It kind of like reinforces the idea of how it happened. But yeah, it was not, it was something that sort of evolved. I didn't really, I really thought it'd be a pamphlet. I didn't even know if we'd like get it printed or just print it at home or something. Mm-hmm. But it was so rich in material, again, especially in contrast to how little existed in the public domain with him and my grandmother speaking about his work, that I thought it would make sense, kind of like the New York Public Library interview, to say, like, this is the record of, like, this is the best I can give you of the record of what these, the process of putting these books together and what he has to say about them.
Well, I, for one, am grateful that you did it. And I'm sure I speak for a lot of, photo enthusiasts or photo historians, just such valuable information. And let me ask you, so the idea of the press, and I did read a little bit about sort of like that was originally sort of, I didn't realize it was literally a door-to-door kind of sales approach that your grandparents did. But it also, I think, speaks to, like you said, the market or lack thereof for photo books, certainly at that time. And, you know, I mean, even photo publishing today, it's such a niche kind of part of the publishing world. But to think about it from the standpoint of, yes, that was sort of like self-publishing then. Obviously there were museum exhibits, that there were catalogs and books that kind of went along with those throughout his career. But going back to sort of like, so he's just got stacks of his old books that are just piled up around the house, and it's like, you know, we got to move these things. So,
pretty much.
In some ways, like as a self-publisher in a very small scale for myself, but like thinking about, like, I think that is always, you know, and like we're talking about Lee Friedlander, who's a fucking, you know, giant in art photography. But like anybody who's self-publishing has to reconcile the fact that, like, okay, well, what do you do with all those books, you know, once they're printed, or they don't sell right away, or, you know, that, you know, and it's a realistic challenge. You know, the luxury that you guys have is that he's a known artist. There's, you know, whatever, I don't know what the demand is, and we don't need to talk about like the details of the business. But then I look at, like, well, if I had 20 grand lying around, would I probably be a person that would buy that box of the 50 books. Yeah. But then, like you said, like, okay, and now, like, I've got, like, now, like, what do you do with it? And so, like, I find it interesting to, like, can you just talk a little bit, and you don't have to get into like specifics, but just like what it's like to be sort of the conduit for these books and this work to sort of still make its way out into the world today.
Yeah. Like you said, it's a different, it's not growing a business from scratch, obviously. Like, there's a built-in recognition and demand and everything. I've always seen myself, I mean, with Lee and his work, is more like a steward of it. I know a lot of, there's just a lot of cautionary tales over the years that I've heard of, you know, photographers, creating a bunch of just a legacy for themselves and having a huge output. And then there's, you know, and then what, you know, then it sort of falls into disrepair and who's representing them. And I just never, you know, I take it seriously from my perspective, just like making sure that his work gets into the people's hands that want it, and that it's represented well, and that people hear what he have to say when he wants that. And so, you know, that's like sort of just the personal element of it. It's, you know, his creative life is truly his own. It always has been. You know, I love looking at his dummies when he has them, he shows them to me. And I love being in his studio and seeing what he's working on and how he does it. But, you know, that's obviously not my or anyone else's role. It's not like I'm just saying, oh, what do you think would sell? What do you think people, it's never, mm-hmm. it's never like that for him. It's not like that for me, obviously. So it's truly taking what he wants to do and making sure that there's, like I was trying to, you know, kind of explain that there's just representation for it, because the galleries, again, they're not really in the book business. They're at a higher price point. And one of the big impetuses as well, not just the books, but Lee did something kind of interesting with, we call them his special editions. He collaborated with this bookbinder named George Week. There's not much about him on the internet, I've looked, but he was a master bookbinder, and they did these, I think there's maybe 10 of them. The way it worked was there'd be a book, a trade edition book, like these Factory Valleys, let's say. And then there was a limited run that he would do with this binder, George Week, where they would be put in a special binding. There'd be prints either tipped in or included in a folio in the back. And there are these kind of interesting art objects that he made because he wanted to make them. And they were real collaborations. It wasn't like you do use this fabric, use that. I mean, the bookbinder had enormous creative direction over it. And they were, a lot of them were just sort of sitting there. I mean, there's some that had sold. And I remember my dad telling me that years ago he had sold some. I mean, again, before my parents were married, they were friends. And so they were sort of this like other, you know, cousin of his work almost. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I know how much he loved them. I love them as well. And I was important to me that to give other people the opportunity to not just purchase them, but just know about them and see them in pictures on the website and speak about them. So, you know, there's that aspect of it that's, you know, it's a business element, but there's also just a personal element. It matters to me to have what he loves out into the world. But yeah, I mean, from you asking about the books, are there books ever? The answer is yes. I wrote about this in the introduction to Friedlander First 50, the book. I realized after a while that the books were sort of roughly chronological. Mm. Based on where they were in the house, you know, there was one area, one room, one closet, whatever. And then roughly they'd start piling up somewhere else. And there's some part of my grandpa's studio was an addition that was made to the house, years after, but they've been living in the same house for, I think, 65 years, maybe more. Hmm. And it was a studio was an addition to it. And then they started piling up there. And it occurred to me that the house literally expanded with the books. And I think that was not necessarily the reason, but it was without those extra rooms, I don't know where they would be. So there's not, you know, like a book room necessarily, but they're all just wherever there is space, boxes, free copies. My grandpa's a very organized person when it comes to that. I mean, his workspace is used so frequently that it kind of needs to be to say, oh, you know, where is this print? You can get it, knows where it is. And same thing with the books. But there is also an aspect of, well, you know, no one starts their career and says, I'm going to print 80 books and I'm going to have a warehouse. That, you know, there's an element that they are sort of just wherever there's room. So they're organized, but not fully categorized with any discernible logic. So but that's kind of the charm to it. There's no end point. It's like, I want to do 50 books and then stop. No, he's going to be making his two books just about to come out. He's going to be making books absolutely as long as he can. So
yeah. Are there still books all over the house,
I mean, they're not like in the kitchen, but you know what I mean? Like, yeah, in the non-living spaces. Yeah. And in the studio and the closet here, there. Yeah.
So when you're, but like, did you personally like assemble, like, I mean, is there a storage space? Like, how to explain, like, if I'm ordering a book, like a special edition book, I've got, yeah, you know, like 10 grand to burn, and I want that, like, special. There's one, where is it? Maybe not 10 grand, but there's a couple that are this pricey. Okay. So I order it. To explain the process to me then.
So I ship it from my house in Brooklyn, but okay. I go up there and sort of, and I've been doing this for, I think it was 2015, so maybe 8 years now. But going up and having him sign books, then I bring him home and boxes with foam around them, and then I have my own stock of a few copies of each one, and it sometimes sell out, and I go up and get more, and it's a nice I love visiting my grandparents.
Even yeah.
To visit them. It's also nice to have a reason, and it makes it kind of fun. There's like a little game to it, and you know, of finding them and locating them and having them sign them and loading into the car. And it's also, I will say, it is a good workout too. Books are a lot heavier than you think. I learned this the hard way. But yeah, so they all ship for me. But you know, here's an example. So the book that just came out called Framed. It was a show and a book,
right?
Done with Joel Cohen, the Cohen brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's its own interesting story there. But there, when it came in, so they get, you know, the books get, he got X amount of, I don't even remember, but X amount of books shipped to his home. And I went and lugged them in from, those got, I think, delivered to the garage just because that's where FedEx left them, and brought them in, opened them, signed them, brought them to my car, sold them. And that's sort of it. I mean, and that one sold, you know, because Joel Cohen's attached and it just came out. The new ones, especially in the beginning, there's a lot of, you know, there's more hype around them. That one's, I mean, sold out very quickly. And so, you know, I maybe went out once or twice to get all the books because there were, you know, I could only fit so many in my car. Yeah, it really is that. That's for a newer one. The older ones that are, I mean, I'll tell you, with self-portrait, you were asking, like, what do you do with self-published books? It's not like you sold all of them, obviously, because I'm selling some. But there were, you know, I remember seeing a box that, you know, it's a book that was published in, I think, 1960. There was what was that, 60 plus years ago, that had never been opened. Because you didn't sell all of them. And mm-hmm. I remember one store in particular, I think this is even in Revender First 50, this story, but they were selling for $5 and they said, would you sign them too? He said, no, that's, I'm not, you know, they're selling them unsigned. They said, okay, well, we don't want them. He said, okay, well, that's too bad. You know, he, which I like that he believed in himself, and now it sells for many times more than that. But he didn't sell all of them, and they're, you know, it's great for me, and he gets thrilled over too that they're in, like, there's some that are in pristine condition, some aren't, obviously, but he sat on them. He was, you know, and I don't think the vision was, yes, sure, I'll have a grandson that years later will sell them for, but I think there was this, like, I want to get as many out as possible that I can, but also, you know, if I have some left over, so be it. Like, that's where I came in. So that's, I guess, a little bit about the last book, the most recent book, and the first book.
Right. Yeah. And so, like for example, The American Monument, that book to me, and I purchased, I guess, when that second edition came, I'm at the website. So the second edition, 2017, right. Just and personal story. So I was always, some reason I was attracted to that work, even like when I was studying photography in college, and had at the time pre-internet and everything, and trying to track down that work in book form. I was never able to do it. And then I found a copy of the Center for Creative Photography in Tucson had put out like a archive, issue, like their, you know, semi-annual whatever, and it featured that work, and that was as close as I could get to owning that body of work until this edition came out. And not only so, I think just in a roundabout way, the value of what you're doing, and that it's not some random third party, you know, who's kind of like swooping in and, you know, kind of managing the stock or whatever, that it's, in essence, it's a family business, that it's a personal, I love it. Like, you know, like, shit, I need, like, oh, we've sold a few more American Monuments. I got to drive up to his house.
Yeah. That's really what it is. And it's, I, you know, as someone who has my own creative heroes, I thought it was a great, I thought people would enjoy knowing that they came from his home. And that, you know, this borders on the superstitious or the spiritual or whatever, but you know, it's a book that's been sitting in his home for however it could, you know, 60 years for one book or 20 years for another. But, cause obviously part of what a signature is just psychologically is that the person touched it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they, you know, there's beyond just, you know, cause if you think hard enough about a signature, and I hate to say this as someone who sells signed books, but you know, what is it, right? It's an interesting question. I used to collect signed baseballs that I would go to Yankee spring training with my parents. God bless them for taking me. And, you know, spending from, you know, 5-6 in the morning till dinner by the practice fields in Tampa, Florida. I'd wait for the cars to come in. I knew when they came in. I knew who drove what. I know when they left. I knew where they ate lunch. I knew where they did. I mean, it was like a psycho endeavor, but it was super fun. You know, talking about games like that.
Yeah,
was,
yeah.
Knew what field the minor leaguers were on, what the field, you know, everything. And the goal, and this was the game, was to get them to sign a baseball. I never sold any of them. I probably should have at the time. But then you know, most of my memories aren't really about the signatures. It's about having interacted for a second with a player or having gone to a place where I knew they'd be and getting to see them up close. You know what I mean? The signature is almost like a record of a memory or something like that. And even when you buy something that you weren't there for, it's a record of a physical interaction that they touched it. It was,
absolutely
home. Yeah. And I thought people would enjoy that just beyond like, you know, buying it else, you know, you see a copy on eBay that someone had years ago. Like I thought people would enjoy the fact that it was in his home, around where he's created. Again, to me, as someone who has experienced that sort of appeal, not just with the signature, but, you know, having creative heroes, like that proximity to the creative process, I thought would be interesting for people to have a record of, a remnant of.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, you know, like, and, you know, I'm going to set aside sort of the, you know, the collector mentality or added value, obviously, of like having a signed version of something versus unsigned. But like, and I think like people listening to this conversation will share that just what you described and just what to me makes it, you know, like that, just that idea of that this is, you know, like I don't think I realized that until we spoke, is that, you know, these are his stash of books, and it's and I love just like you're part of, like, you're the recipient of this process of it being like, you know, not only his work from his mind and his eyes and his spirit, and then the book process of laying out, and we, you know, that's a whole other conversation of you know, like you mentioned, like I gotta go back to that, what comment you made, or like he shows you the dummy of the book, like I was just like, fuck, man, like Lee Friedland just handing you. Yeah, I know he's your grandfather, but it's like you just, just the beauty of like having that opportunity, right? So that's special. And it is special that, like, you know, okay, like he in his hand signed this book, and it's not, you know, it's not like, again, like this is a niche thing. It's a very specific audience, but someone like me that elevates it. It makes it very, very special. And I think that there's, you know, like that's, you know, just the value in that goes beyond like, oh, and here we have a signed copy of the first edition that's starting value at X amount of, you know, like that.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you feel that way. And something you said earlier too, about you mentioned about the road trips and also about looking through his dummies. Like it's easy for me to forget, you know, he's only ever been my grandpa to me. You know what I mean? So there is a sense of this is just who he is, and this is our relationship. I'm touched that he ever wants to show me his work and what he's working on. Any artist will, you know, tell you that that's the most vulnerable stage, when it's like, it's still in the embryo, you know, it's not fully done, but you think this is what it will be. And, but I do try to live both realities, that, you know, this is someone who, you know, not just that they're, you know, important, or I'm doing air quotes, but to me, what's inspiring, what I try to take from him, just because I'm not a photographer. I mean, I've taken pictures before and I've enjoyed it, but I wouldn't call myself a photographer. But he you know, he's someone who works, and that's sort of how he defines himself. That this, you know, I think he's definitely born with an eye that, you know, in this way, everyone who's good at something is like born with a little something. But what's really inspiring to me is just to see how he's built his life and quite literally built his home around his creative process. You know, vacations are also to photograph, and it's not like I'm going to set out time and then I'm going to sit by the pool. It's one fluid thing. It's life is work. Work is life. They are not work to play, play to work. No, it's one thing. And his home is kind of like that too. His dark room and studio are just a flight of stairs away. And when you have that, and I know it's a luxury, obviously, in Manhattan, you know, living in New York City, it's like incredibly hard to do that. But, you know, part of why he lives where he lives is because he was able to do that, you know. And so when he shares his work with me, I have that family, the grandfather, grandchild bond that I'm very grateful for. But I do try to tap into a different part of my brain that, you know, I'm aware of the significance and where how accomplished he is. And I try to see that through the lens of, you know, this is what's possible when you really give your life to something, not just dedicate it, but surrender to your work to the extent that I'm trying to use my words very carefully, because I think it goes beyond what we generally think about in today's like hustle culture of like, oh, I was up for 18 hours. Oh, I was up for 19. I had 18 shots of coffee. It's like, okay, it's not to say there's anything wrong with that necessarily if that's what you need to do, but that's not him. It's when you make your life about something out of a sort of inborn love, and you can love something, you could want to do it, but committing your life to it is another matter. And to me, he's done it in a way that's not, it doesn't even, there's hard work, there's not to me a ton of sacrifice. I mean that in the best way possible, because I think if he could be doing anything on earth, it would be either photographing or putting together a book. I don't think that his true love is to, you know, sit on a beach, but he knows he's got to pay the bills. Like, it's not that. It's when you kind of make your life about, you know, you give your life to something, and that's what I've seen him do. And it's really inspiring to me.
Wonderful. I think that's a perfect place to finish the conversation.
Yeah,
that's great. Well, thank you so much for taking time out. I'll share links to all the things that we were talking about, and listeners can get a book that you ran upstate to get a copy of and ship out to them. But Giancarlo, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Of course. I had a great time. Thank you for having me.
So there you go, folks, my conversation with Giancarlo Roma of Haywire Press and the grandson of Lee Friedlander. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Just thinking about the opportunity to roll around in a car out in the desert with Lee Friedlander taking photographs is something that I would just imagine is so special. But also being so, you know, connected in a family way, and then also professionally with such a master artist, I think is just something that's really cool and really special. So as I said earlier, I will definitely share links to where you can find all the books that we were talking about, as well as that video at the New York Public Library, which is actually really got me excited to set up this interview in the first place. So before I wrap things up, just want to remind you that if you wanted to ask me any questions or check out any of the other episodes of this podcast, you can go to righteyedominantpodcast.com and find all that stuff there. Scroll down to the bottom and then you can send me comments or questions. And if you could, please leave me a rating and or a review on your platform of choice, specifically the Apple Podcast platform, will help me keep growing this audience. I'm very excited
to see how many new listeners are coming on board. And I find it really satisfying that lots of folks are enjoying this project. So that's it for now. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Toro Jr. And until next time, stay well.
This podcast has been a production of righteyedominant.art. The music for today's episode is brought to you by The Comic Project and Yazar.